is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be with Thomas Cahill. We're talking about the mysteries of the Middle Ages, where, I'm going to quote you, romance turns into prayer and life turns into art. The art part with Giotto was great fun, as you, and it's really true of Dante as well. So you're both looking at the physical paintings, architecture, and literature as life goes into art in very new ways in this predecessor to the Renaissance.
Well, for his contemporaries, Giotto was painting reality.
That's G-I-O-T-T-O. That's
right.
And this is a guy, an ugly guy, by the way.
Yes, he was. He was short and brutal looking.
He's
wonderful.
He's luminous.
Yeah. We look at his paintings and they look like medieval paintings to us, but to his contemporaries, they thought, wow.
Holy cow.
This is what things really look like for the first time. Why? Because the art before that was really the icon. It was the Greek icon and things influenced by the Greek icon, so that you had flat figures, usually extremely thin because they were very ascetic.
No context.
No context at all, except gold behind them very often. They're an individual saint staring out at you. Nobody smiles ever. You know?
Two eyes bearing down on you.
Right. They really are figures to be worshipped. That's really what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Giotto has people. He has many people in the same frame. They're facing one another. He's the first person to really do lots and lots of profiles. And he puts Christ in profile. And Christ, even Christ, is on the same level as everybody else and is engaged as a human being with other human beings.
Which, again, is heresy to the authority of that moment.
Well, it's not heresy exactly. It's just shocking. You know, nobody stopped Giotto. Once they saw it, it made perfectly good sense. And Giotto really is a child of St. Francis. He's very much, he belongs to the Franciscan movement. And it is Francis who I think really got the thing underway. Francis invented the Christmas creche. He said, and what was he doing? Well, he brought a cow and a donkey into the church. And
that would be into the church!
Right, he brought in hay. And we know that he had a nursing mother and her child sit there as the Virgin and the child. And he said, well, what was he doing? Well, I think we want to see what it really looked like. That's what we're trying to do. What did it actually look like? What did it feel like? This is the beginning of realism in art. It's the end of what had been. And it's people asking the question, well, what did it look like? What did it feel like? What would it have been like to have been there? This is a completely new question. And it is the beginning of realism, whether in the plastic arts or in theater or finally in literature.
Score one for Aristotle.
Once again. Right.
Well, and the same thing with Dante. He's he is not writing fairy tales about the far distant past. He is taking the theology, or a good piece of it, and bringing it almost brutally into the very real present.
And the feeling of exile that is so dominant in his life, and he's willing to call names.
Yeah. Well, of course, he's writing about hell, purgatory, and heaven, which most of us have not visited yet. So the frame of his greatest work, I mean, he has many works, but the frame of his greatest work is the world after death and what might happen there. But he's really writing psychologically. He's writing about how people have lived and where they belong as a result of how they've lived.
Well, and the Boniface that is his tormentor, the Pope, he puts just about as far down in hell as he can get.
Yeah, we meet in Dante's work a lot of bishops, cardinals, and popes in hell. which is obviously where he thought they belonged.
I was really struck that as you talked about Dante, that lust, pride, and avarice, as you characterize them, are the three things that are just the bottom of hell, which sound, and this is not a digression, sound a lot like what Joseph Campbell at least characterizes for the Buddha, saying that we should eschew fear, social conformity, and attachment, lust. These big ideas are able to find expression in the West through the arts in ways that just doesn't happen any other way.
The lustful are at the top of hell, not the bottom.
Oh, forgive me.
The lustful, obviously.
Well, that's an important
Dante
distinction.
Yes, I think so.
Yes.
Dante himself had...
pretty lusty guy.
Let's say that sin was not unknown to Dante. And he puts them at a point that's almost not hell. It's just a little bit not as wonderful as
purgatory, which
as heaven. Purgatory is the place you know you're going to get out of.
Work your way out of that.
Eventually. So however bad it is.
There's a certain Calvinist quality to it.
Yes. But the people at the very bottom of hell are the ones who betrayed one another. Betrayal and of one kind or another is really the worst sin in Dante. And the people who did things out of passion, whether it was lust or anger, are much closer to the top of hell. It's the bottom of hell where Satan is, and that's really the very, very worst.
And what? Judas.
Judas is down there because he's a betrayer.
Right.
And in Dante's own life, he saw that he saw betrayal as the worst sin. He was betrayed by the leaders of Florence, which is why he ended up on the road and could never go back to Florence and really became a wanderer for his whole life. And that wandering was extremely useful to us. I in many ways think that The Divine Comedy may be the best book ever written. It's just so wonderful.
You do invite us to it as you're telling its story.
You also say that right at the core of what's behind the entire comedy, and it was originally comedy, not Divine Comedy, thank you for clarifying is truthfulness in its absence. And again, that goes to this relationship to the world around you and being willing to acknowledge reality when it hits you between the eyes. And it seems to me, again, that this is just dead center of what was happening, that focus on the real world as opposed to an imaginary world.
Yeah.
And even to the extent that this is, you know, we're talking about an afterlife, we have no direct experience. Everything he writes about is very tangible. It is it is corporeal in its detail about you know, every stage from heaven to hell.
Yeah, yeah.
And it does sound like Roger Bacon fooling around with what's really true, doesn't
it? Yes, it does. They have a lot in common. And of course, it's a comedy because it ends well. It doesn't end, you know, you end up, at the end of the comedy, you're in heaven. And the ending is so beautiful.
But he never lets the guys who are the betrayers off. They stay where they belong in his...
Yeah, no, Dante can be very harsh.
But that goes to justice. I mean, that's what this is all about.
Exactly, and it ties to the Hebrew tradition of justice.
Yeah, very much so.
Yes, we'll agree on that. I thought you were going to say more.
We agree on many things.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Well, back to justice. Sure.
Eloise, to me, you said that it ends badly, but in some ways she is as a character. Eleanor of Aquitaine is just good, clean fun, and it's wonderful to watch her grow and learn and change and become a much richer, stronger person. But in some ways, Eloise does the same thing. She started out very bright.
Yes.
But then
she's a kid. She's a teenager.
Yeah, and develops what I by your accounting, and that's the one I have to rely on, is just a stunning amount of character.
Yeah. Yeah.
And becomes a truly rich, good person.
Yeah.
Well, it starts with her just saying, I'm not going to get married because that just changes everything.
Right. I'd rather be your whore. Thanks all the same. There's a woman who knows what she thinks.
Doesn't sound very medieval, does it?
That's what I said, but, you know, there she is. And, in fact, for years, her letters were thought by scholars to be forgeries because they thought no medieval woman could have said these things or written these things. But now we know we're much better at analyzing style. And, you know, it would be very hard for a 20th century person, when these letters were rediscovered, to have written in the Latin style of the 12th century. You know, Latin style is one thing, you know, but not, there's too much that's characteristic. We know they're her letters. This is a real person. This is what she was like. And I would agree with you that she is maybe in some ways the person who's closest to us of all of these people. She's the most modern. There are many modern people tending toward the modern in this book, but she's there. She's completely so.
And she is beautiful.
Oh, yeah. She's terrific.
Throughout Mysteries of the Middle East, you give us beauty
of the Middle Ages.
Throughout Mysteries of the Middle Ages and the beginning of the modern world, there is great beauty. And we'll be back for a couple more minutes of it with Thomas Cahill. Be with us when we return.